From the JAMA Network, this is JAMA Clinical Reviews, interviews and ideas about innovations in medicine, science, and clinical practice.
I'm Dr. Ann Coppola, Associate Editor at JAMA and a practicing endocrinologist at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Today, we will be discussing an article and an editorial in the June 8th issue of JAMA. I'm joined by Dr. Jeff Linder, Chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine and Geriatrics, and the Michael A. Gertz Professor of Medicine at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. We will be discussing his article entitled General Health Checks in Adult Primary Care, a Review. Welcome, Dr. Linder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also joining us is Dr. Alan Brett, who recently transitioned from the University of South Carolina School of Medicine to the Department of Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. His editorial is entitled The Routine General Medical Checkup, Valuable Practice or Unnecessary Ritual. Welcome, Dr. Brett.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to start by asking Jeff a few questions just to tell us a little bit about his article. So starting with, how do you define general health checks?
Yeah, the listeners will refer to these more often as checkups or routine visits or wellness visits. We use general health checks because that's what's been used in the literature to now to study the same idea. And this is a visit to overwhelmingly primary care practices when you're feeling well. You don't have any symptoms, you're not addressing any common diseases, and we wanted to know, are general health checks associated with better outcomes for patients?
And why did you decide to review this topic now?
Well, my co-authors and I were impressed by prior reviews that had gotten at this topic, but they were pretty narrow in scope. So they looked very narrowly, for example, at just randomized controlled trials that looked at mortality as an outcome or cardiovascular outcomes. And we were interested in looking at a broader array of outcomes that we'll get into in a minute, but also being a little bit more ecumenical about what types of studies we were willing to include in a review of general health checks.
Great. So now would be a great time to summarize your findings for us and to let us know what you think the take-home message is from your article.
So we looked at studies from these prior reviews and then new literature from the year 2000 through 2021. And we included studies that involved primary care visits that were either randomized controlled trials or observational studies that had a control group or of a certain size. And we, after looking through about 2,000 some odd articles, we found 32 that met all of our inclusion and exclusion criteria. And we were interested in seeing, do general health checks improve things or have an influence in several domains? And so we looked at, do general health checks reduce your chance of dying? And there we found no consistent effect. We looked at, do they reduce your chance of having a cardiovascular outcome like a heart attack or stroke? And also found no consistent effect. We also looked, do general health checks help detect chronic diseases like high blood pressure, diabetes, depression? And here we start to see some benefit. We also looked at whether general health checks help you control risk factors like blood pressure, cholesterol, and your weight. And we found some small benefits there. Another domain we looked at was, does getting a general health check improve people's receipt of recommended preventive services like mammography, colonoscopy, vaccinations? Definitely there. Do general health checks improve health behaviors like eating right or exercising? And we found variable associations with some improvements in exercise and diet. And then the last area of benefit we looked at, do general health checks improve patients' sense of well-being or quality of life? And there's some evidence that yes. So general health checks do decrease patients' health, worry, and anxiety, and they improve patients' sense of well-being, quality of life, and self-rated health, which we can circle back to later in the conversation. And then lastly, we looked, do general health checks have any adverse effects, which people might not think about? Like what would the potential adverse effect be of going to seeing a physician? And here we found four studies that identified potential adverse effects. And it's definitely worth saying that most studies of general health checks didn't look for potential adverse effects. And to be fair, the studies that found adverse effects, you know, kind of went looking pretty hard. So one study, there was increased mortality due to increased completion of advanced directives. So patients were getting more patient concordant end of life care. And then we found a couple other adverse effects like an increase in stroke in one study, and then one study increases in condition-specific hospitalizations. But by and large, studies didn't look at adverse effects in kind of a systematic way. So all told, you put that all together, so mortality, cardiovascular outcomes, patient-reported outcomes, and adverse effects, it's kind of a mixed bag. And I think a lot of people who are proponents of general health checks might be surprised that, you know, they won't necessarily help you live longer. It's certainly never been shown to be the case. But it does improve patients' sense of well-being, quality of life, and you definitely are more likely to get recommended health services.
So with that, I think I'll then move on to Alan and ask him to expand a little bit more on some of the pros and cons that Jeff mentioned in his summary and what you think those are. So some of this can be based on the data, but some of it can even be, Alan, if you have some personal experiences that you want to put in there, you know, certainly share with us what your opinion is.
Well, first of all, let me congratulate Jeff on a very nice paper, Jeff and his colleagues. It seems to me that reading the paper and the outcomes that Jeff nicely summarized there, it's kind of a half empty, half full. Depending on how you read it, you might be impressed or disillusioned by general health checks. But to answer your question about pros and cons, it seems to me that this general health check, periodic exam, whatever you want to call it, has three potential roles. And one would be arranging for validated preventive screenings or interventions like immunizations. The second would be to find out if the patient has developed any new potentially important symptoms since the last encounter or any medical events that I was not aware of that occurred in the interim. And even though Jeff defined this as asymptomatic people, you know, patients make lists of minor things that they'll bring to these visits. And then third, providing time and space to strengthen the patient-doctor relationship. So those are three sorts of things that could be embedded in a productive general health check. So the pro is that this could be an efficient way to accomplish all those things, with the caveat that you need time to do that. As long as the clinician's given ample time for that session, I think there's value in all three of those things. If it's a rushed encounter, then the opposite. I think it can be a con, and people are trying to stuff things into a short appointment time. And then one other con I thought about is that I think there's a bit of deception here. In other words, I think a lot of patients, they hear, you know, yearly physical, routine health maintenance, whatever you want to call it, it gives the perception of, I think, probably more value than can be corroborated by the literature that Jeff reviewed. I'm talking about concrete, objective, hard medical endpoints. I think that in the patient's mind, sometimes that's an exaggerated benefit of these somewhat ritualistic visits, whether they're annual or otherwise.
Thank you. You know, Jeff, going back to you, I mean, even one of your cons, the advanced directive planning, really is a pro. You know, it turned out in terms of higher mortality, but really that's something the advanced directive, hard to, I think, do in any other way aside from having this kind of in-person visit. And often I would think better to do when you don't have acuity occurring at that visit. And so when things are calmer, perhaps. You know, any other thoughts that you have, particularly in hearing what Alan said about the pros and cons, or even ways you could think of reconfiguring this visit so perhaps it's more effective?
It brings up a lot. And actually, to jump back to something Alan said a minute ago, this idea of it glass being half full or half empty. I mean, my co-authors and I have been discussing that this is a little bit like a Rorschach test. Like there's something, I guess to put it negatively, there's something in here for everybody to hate. That if, from the doctor's perspective, you know, if the intent of general health checks is to get recommended preventive services, is to get vaccinations, is to simply detect chronic disease, one's left with the question, does a doctor really need to be involved in much of it? But also, Alan alluded to this very important aspect of relationship building. I think that's an important part of general health checks, building a relationship with a trusted healthcare professional that might not happen any other way. And to be clear, that's not something we measured in our study. So yeah, you could look at this a couple of different ways.
And do you think, you know, going back to you, Alan, can you talk a little bit more about this intangible value, or and maybe even also comment on some of the things that Jeff just said about how do we separate out the good from the less good aspects of it?
You know, this interesting issue of what is measurable and what is not. You know, most published studies will, data-driven studies will record what's measurable. So you use the word intangible. You know, the intangible part of it has to do with continuity of care. And I'm of the opinion not everything has to be proven by a randomized trial. There's some intuitive things that I think we can hopefully accept as reasonably valuable. So some of these intangible things that one could get might be establishing trust. And to turn that into a more tangible outcome, if there's trust, I think it lowers the threshold at which a patient might be willing to share important information that has bearing on their health, important medical information, but might be withheld in the absence of a trusting relationship. So that's a potential intangible good thing that can come out of it. And of course, let me just parenthetically say, a lot of what I'm going to say now has to do with a presumption of a long-term relationship. If we're in a health system where the patient's seeing somebody different each time, none of this almost matters, okay? And then another intangible thing would be getting to know the patient as a person, helping to facilitate sort of patient-centered decision-making. So when the patient does become ill or develop a medical problem, we are already sort of one step ahead in understanding how the patient might cope with it and what the patient might want. I have this kind of theory that some patients, this isn't exactly black and white, some patients are less is more sorts of patients. Don't do anything to me unless you have really good evidence that it's helpful. And then there's some patients who prefer interventions when indications for tests or treatments are borderline, this sort of more is more patient. And we know that often when we get to know a patient, and that makes it a lot easier to help talk through illness when that occurs. I think there's an intangible time saver. Again, we're kind of talking about, you know, some kind of periodic visits where the patient has already developed a relationship. When I know that patient, in part from these annual or periodic visits, when something does happen, I don't need to dig into inaccessible, buried medical records. I know right at the top of my hat something about that patient's past medical history that allows me to actually save time on the other end. And then the last thing that's intangible that I did write about in my editorial that I don't think people have written about, and it just hasn't been part of the reviews, is on the physician side. Is there an intangible benefit for the physician having some sort of periodic checks, whatever you want to call them, satisfaction from the physician side that comes from getting to know one's patients? Burnout has been flagged as a big problem, including in primary care in recent years. The AMA itself has stated that creating a practice environment that strengthens doctor-patient connections could mitigate burnout. I think I happen to agree with that. And, you know, Jeff and I have read tons of essays by fourth year students who are applying for residencies in primary care related fields. And what's a big theme in those essays? The opportunity to get to know a patient on a long term basis. And so to the extent that we can foster that by some sort of a repeated encounter, maybe that will mitigate burnout. Can't prove that, but maybe.
And actually, if I can jump in for a second about your original question, Anne, about intangible benefits, and I would come back to that domain we looked at. So patient reported outcomes, sense of well-being and quality of life. So these visits are associated with clear improvements in quality of life, decreased health worry and anxiety. And it's interesting to take that and then think about the lack of association or the lack of proven association with reduced chance of dying, reduced chance of cardiovascular outcomes. So nothing in the literature said why patients have this improved sense of well-being. So if it was because they thought they, you know, I'm good, I'm healthy, that is sort of unfounded in a way that Alan alluded to kind of right at the beginning of our conversation. But if it is because the patient feels like they have a better, stronger relationship with an understanding healthcare professional, then that sense of well-being is completely warranted.
How hard do you think that is to measure in the setting of a clinical trial? Because we're talking about what you can assess in a randomized trial versus what we're seeing in practice with longitudinal relationships. And can you really get at that longitudinal relationship through a trial?
I think you actually could. We don't typically do it, but there are measures that we could use where you're detecting a patient's perception of their connection with an individual or with a practice. So I think that is doable. And other national studies use as a measure, you know, do you have somebody you would go to for most of your health concerns? So, you know, is somebody connected and do they feel that they have access to available primary care?
Alan, I'm going to ask about whether that contact has to be in person or not. So, you know, Jeff, I'm sure you're going to tell me that all these studies were done before there was really much telemedicine going on. And so, Alan, do you think the physical exam is important? And even if you don't think it's important, how important do you think it needs to be an in-person versus a telemedicine visit?
Wow. I think many of us got a chance to try to sort of figure that out during the pandemic. And it was really interesting. I found, and we'll see if Jeff had a similar experience, that one could do an amazing amount of stuff with some combination of phone and video, quote, visits during the pandemic. But there were some caveats. When anything more than kind of a trivial physical exam was required, now this is for patients with symptoms, I think we found creative ways to do sort of physical exams virtually, but for many of them, we had to bring patients in, patients who developed symptoms that required hands-on. And the other thing is that not everybody on the other end was interested in lengthy virtual visits, and particularly I had a very older population. There were technical issues that we fumbled around with trying to do video stuff that often wasted time. So there are technical reasons and other reasons that, you know, it's like everything else. If you pick and choose correctly, phone and video visits can be of immense help. But I think for many of us older primary care physicians, we did a lot of phone medicine before this. We just didn't bill for it, you know? So yeah, it's one component that can be valuable in this conversation. But certainly at some point, one has to be in more intimate contact with the patient.
Yeah, I would pick up on that and make two points. First, that I agree that telemedicine kind of opening up as a potential benefit of the pandemic has been good. And this idea that we can do a lot, you know, there's a lot of what I'm listing here about preventive services and chronic disease detection. Like I said earlier, it doesn't have to be done by a doctor, does not have to be done in person. And I've said for a long time, probably 50 to 80% of what we do in primary care doesn't really need to have the patient there. And I think we could do a lot better at being more efficient about it. Along those lines is this idea that you have to do it all in one visit. And the idea of like, if you can't do it all in a telemedicine visit and then the patient has to come in, that's somehow a failure. I think we need to kind of break this paradigm of the in-person visit is this high stakes encounter where like everything has to get done, or a telemedicine visit is just a telemedicine visit. And if it's associated at all with an in-person visit, it's like I alluded to before, it's somehow a failure. The second point I would make, we make this in the paper, and apologies to my co-authors because I was adamant about this point, is this term, the annual physical, drives me a little bit crazy because the annual physical needs to be neither, generally speaking. So, and I'm sure Alan has this all the time. We have our patients coming and they're like, I'm here for my annual physical. So for a young, healthy person, it doesn't have to be annual. And the only parts of the physical exam that really have strong evidence that we should be doing them on people without symptoms are checking your weight and checking your blood pressure. And that's it. And so the idea that you need an annual physical, I sort of hope this opens a conversation that we can kind of break that a little bit and do all of the delivery of these services and relationship building in a more efficient, effective way.
Let me add on to those points. I think flexibility is the key here. I think both of us, I think we're pretty much aligned, Jeff and I, that there are certain things that we would like to accomplish in long-term relationships with patients. So we can be flexible about when they are and to what extent they're by phone or in person and so forth. And so, for example, a very common paradigm in my practice is, let's say, a patient who is middle-aged or a little bit older, who has several medical problems on several medications, who it makes sense to see them, oh, say, every 6 months or so. And in those visits, again, you have to have time built in, which is a whole nother issue about what our medical system is doing to rush doctor-patient encounters. If you build in enough time for those every 6 month visits to look at their diabetes, their hypertension, the common chronic medical problems, then around the edges of those visits, you can fill in the preventive things, the getting to know what's happened in the patient's life in the interim 6 months and so forth. And sometimes those patients will say, well, do I also need a yearly physical? And I'll say, you don't need to come back again. I think in our 2 or 3 times a year problem-oriented visits, we can cover all the relevant stuff for you. And I think most patients are very satisfied with handling things that way.
Hear, hear. Yeah, agreed.
So Jeff, you mentioned that, and you both have said, it doesn't necessarily have to be an annual visit. You know, what if someone has had a good year, they don't have any problems that come up, but they are on medication, you know, antihypertensive, et cetera. So the medication refills, I think, in some ways are what prompt people to need to come in. Is there a way, do you think we can just do the refills without seeing people every year? Or if somebody is on a medication that's a prescription medication, do they need to come in, whether it's for a well visit or an acute problem, at least once a year?
Yeah, I think if we're doing medication monitoring and doing it properly, having some type of check-in, I think, is important. So blood pressure medicine is a good example. If somebody's been on stable on a blood pressure medicine for a decade or more and is doing okay, we might have a telemedicine visit, maybe coupled with them popping into a lab to get some blood drawn just to make sure things are going okay, and might not need to do an in-person visit. If the situation is more complicated and, you know, somebody with diabetes, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, that, you know, then the calculus about how often you need to see them and do you need to see them in person is very different.
Yeah, I do the same thing. If a person, the exact patient, the first one that Jeff described, somebody who's, say, young to middle age, 1 or 2 medications, things have been perfectly stable for a long time, I'll say, you know, look, we use annual because it's convenient to remember, you know, and so I'll tell the patient, look, I'm willing to see you less than a year in person, but your job is to check in with me some way, you know, every 12 months, or it can be every 6 months, giving me your blood pressures or your blood sugars and so forth. And we can discuss that on the phone. And if all is well, you don't need to come in. Absolutely. And I'll refill the medicines is what I'm trying to say.
So Jeff and Alan, what you've described is very different than the entity that is the executive physical. And that's something, Alan, that you mentioned in your editorial. Would you like to talk a little bit more about should we and can we eliminate the executive physical?
Yeah, I had a paragraph about the executive physical in my editorial, which is kind of something that's always kind of irritated me a bit. You know, my problem with these things that are advertised as executive physicals, and by the way, I Googled executive physical examination as I was writing my editorial, and the hits that you get, many of them come from the most prestigious academic medical centers in the United States. And ironically, I wrote that in those very medical schools, medical students and residents are taught to be skeptical about a lot of the things that are done in their own medical centers in these executive physicals. But basically, the problem with these, quote, executive physicals, it's A, they suggest that an annual head-to-toe physical exam is valuable, whereas there's doubt about that. Secondly, they suggest that these batteries of tests are unequivocally beneficial and standard. And we know that's not true. And maybe even most worrisome, it does suggest that there's a 2-tiered conception of preventive medicine, health promotion, et cetera, and that there's an elite upper class that has unique access to the highest tier of medical care. And I just have a problem with that.
And I would actually make it even worse in some respects. You know, in my own head, when I encounter somebody who has gotten their executive physical, the phrase that goes through my head is like, oh, you've been randomized to worse care. You know, I said we were looking for potential adverse effects of this. We didn't find it in terms of general health checks or checkups, but there's a huge literature about overtesting and overtreatment that just leads to bad stuff, that, you know, more is not better. And we definitely need to break people's conception that that could even be the case. You know, Alan and I, I'm sure we both spend a lot of time chasing after things that are incidentally found on imaging that's of absolutely no consequence to the patient. It takes up a lot of their time, a lot of anxiety, never mind the radiation that they might get. And so, you know, just looking for stuff is not entirely benign. And so that's why, you know, we try to be parsimonious, careful, and very evidence-based in keeping people focused on proven, effective screening modalities for people who don't have any symptoms.
So I have one final question, and I'm going to put this one to Jeff. So, you know, we've talked about really the best way to do things is to develop a relationship with patients and let the frequency and the type of monitoring be guided by the patient. You know, thinking of that, does there need to be another randomized trial in the modern era that incorporates some of the newer things that we're doing now, like telemedicine, like direct messaging through electronic health record? Do you think there needs to be more data in this area, or do you think that your article should, you know, stand for a while? And so what do you think about next steps from here or any trials?
Right. So at the risk of sounding like the typical researcher who says, well, more research is needed, I actually would say yes, but let me preface a longer response with saying within this article, there's some suggestion that, not entirely surprisingly, people who have historically not been connected with primary care, who are overdue for screening, and people who have lower sense of well-being or quality of life are the people who stand to benefit the most from a general health check or a checkup. So I think there's definitely value in checkups. And so that leads us very quickly to those who have not had access to medical care and primary care. So historically underserved groups, areas, like I said, people who are overdue for screening services are the people who stand to benefit the best. So starting from that presumption, many questions then grow out about, okay, well, what's the best way to engage people and get them these services that they haven't historically had? And then, you know, and then we should be, I think, measuring many of these outcomes, from mortality to patient reported outcomes to potential adverse effects.
I hope that we can see that type of study come to light at some point, and then we publish it in JAMA. I'm going to wrap up by asking each of you, Jeff and then Alan, is there something we haven't discussed already that you'd like to let the JAMA audience know about?
I guess just an add-on to the very last comment that Jeff made. I think it's important to think about, because one of his conclusions he said is about the patients who traditionally were underserved. If the problem is lack of access because of the U.S. Sort of chaotic healthcare system, I think the way to go about that is not to sort of do a randomized trial, but to fix our healthcare system to something like a single payer system or some kind of a system that has no barriers to care. If the barriers are other socioeconomic, racial, rural residents and so forth, then there need to be fixes in the way we've deployed healthcare. And then hopefully things will sort of, the pieces will fall into place in terms of preventive medicine and regular health checks. So I think that that's where the time and energy and money needs to be focused, sort of fixing our healthcare system, making access, affordable access, a reality, and not so much in doing more randomized trials, because things are changing so rapidly that I'm afraid that if we try to do any long-term additional randomized trials looking at hard outcomes, the landscape will change and it will become obsolete by the time this trial is done.
Yeah, I would just echo the point about fixing the healthcare system and trying to provide equitable, accessible care for all Americans.
Well, great. Thank you so much. That was Dr. Jeff Linder of Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and Dr. Alan Brett of University of Colorado School of Medicine. Fantastic discussion. This is Dr. Ann Coppola thanking you both for your participation and look forward to reading your articles.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more of our audio at JAMANetworkAudio.com. You can listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.